Ono, Ross, and Carrie, the show where we don't just report on fringe science, claims of the paranormal, and spirituality, but take part ourselves.
Yep, when they make the claims, we show up so you don't have to. I'm Ross Blatcher.
And I'm Carrie Poppy. And today we have Dr. Eugenie Scott, the Executive Director for the National Center for Science Education, on the line.
Hi, Dr. Scott.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thank
you. It's a pleasure.
Normally we show up at the houses of people that we interview and pester
them.
Oh,
I just heard the doorbell ring. You mean you guys are here?
Oh, we wish.
Now, you live in the Northern California area, in the Bay Area?
That's correct. Uh-huh.
But we're all the way down in LA. So we had to do this one by Skype, but we get to see your pretty face on an unmoving image.
Well, the good thing is that we're at least in the same time zone, which I suspect is not always the case for your interviews and isn't the case for me as an interviewee. So this is very pleasant all the way around.
Excellent. So you are with the National Center for Science Education. Can you tell us a bit about that and what you do?
The National Center for Science Education is a membership organization. Most of our members are scientists or people concerned about church and state separation and teachers. And what we have been doing for the last 25 years is trying to keep evolution in the schools and keep religiously oriented views like the various varieties of creationism out of the science class. And just recently, we have added climate change to our portfolio, if you will, since that is another topic that teachers get hammered about for teaching, whereas our position is teachers should teach the consensus view of science as established by professional scientists and university professors. And evolution is accepted science, and that the planet is getting warmer and people have a lot to do with it is also accepted science, and teachers should be able to teach these without political interference.
Yeah, you know, Ross and I were both at the amazing meeting this year, which I think is where you revealed that you guys were tackling climate change. Is that right?
That's right. We had been given the go-ahead by our board of directors not too many months before that, and I believe the TAM meeting was the very first time that we had mentioned to the public that NCSC was going to be pursuing this area. And we now, I'm very happy to say, we now have a new member of our staff. Mark McCaffrey came to us from Boulder, Colorado, where he worked for a climate science research organization. And he's very knowledgeable about climate change education, and we're really raring to go. In fact, we've already had three calls so far from people around the country having problems of one sort or another with the teaching of climate change. One from a parent, one from a teacher, one from a school district. So all we need now is legislation, and we're also, we've got the forfecta there.
You got your work cut out for you. Well, even within the science enthusiast community, there's a lot of controversy over the issue. I mean, I have a lot of friends who would agree that evolution is science, clearly, but would take issue with the consensus on global climate change.
Sure, and that's fine. But if you look at the survey research data, the consensus really is there. We're talking about over 90% of scientists agreeing the planet's getting warmer and people have a lot to do with it. And what you should be teaching at the kindergarten through 12 level is not the arguments among scientists about details, but you should be teaching the basic science.
Mm-hmm.
And our NCSE's concern is that teachers are not being allowed to do this because they're receiving pressure from parents, from administrators, from school districts, school boards, I mean, that try to inhibit the teaching of what is perfectly good science.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a minority of scientists who contend that either the planet isn't getting warmer, or it is getting warmer, but people aren't responsible, or it is getting warmer, people are responsible, but there's nothing we could do about it anyway. I mean, you know, there's all these various views out there.
No unified claim.
Yeah, and I mean, you find minorities supporting each of those views in sort of descending order, so to speak, or ascending order. But the fact is, if you look at the journals, if you look at the scientist associations, you find a very, very high percentage of scientists agreeing with those two points that I mentioned before. And there's a minority of scientists who disagree with this, and fine, go ahead and fight it out. But don't fight it out on the backs of high school teachers.
Right.
Sure.
And you know, if the minority manages to convince the majority, that's fine. Then teachers will teach the new consensus. Mm-hmm. But it's not their job as high school teachers and middle school teachers to be adjudicating the culture wars.
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's very much related to creationism. And if we can take you back to that old chestnut, well, what do you think about creationism? Is it not science or is it just bad science? Is there a difference between the two of those?
It depends on how it's defined, of course. There are many people who are creationists who don't give a hoot about science, and they are creationists simply because that's how they interpret the Bible and that's good enough for them. And they don't care whether there are claims that it can be made scientific or not. Then there's the creation science proponents and the intelligent design proponents who believe that there's scientific warrant to support their points of views, whether it's sort of the young earth special creation view of the folks like Answers in Genesis or Institute for Creation Research, or whether it's the intelligent design view, which is a much more narrowly focused kind of view that there's too much complexity out there in biology or in astronomy to possibly be the result of natural causes, which they equate to chance. So therefore, some intelligence, by which they mean God, had to be involved there, which is, of course, a very fancy and long-winded way of saying special creation all over again. Mm-hmm. Now, both of these camps seem to want to persuade the public that there is scientific warrant for their views. If you look at the claims, well, they lose, because the idea that the whole world was covered by water and Grand Canyon was laid down by Noah's flood and mm-hmm. the Himalayas were pushed up by Noah's flood and all that is just, you know, there's no evidence for it. There's a huge amount of evidence against it, that the bacteria flagellum is irreducibly complex, as the intelligent design mm-hmm. people say. Again, there's no evidence for it. There's a great deal of evidence against it. So in terms of their fact claims, the creationists lose. But fact is not science. What makes it science or not science is whether they view the subject that they're trying to explain, which is the complexity of biology or whatever, are they approaching this in the way that a scientist would approach it? In other words, are they proposing testable explanations, which then they go out and test against the natural world? And using the tests, whether they corroborate or whether they disprove their statements, and whether they build on their discoveries to create more refined questions and more refined tests, is really what makes what would decide whether or not they are scientists. And, you know, the funny thing is that the young earth creationists are closer to doing this than are the intelligent design people. Mm. Because if you look at somebody like Steve Austin of the Institute for Creation Research, I mean, every couple of years he goes out to Grand Canyon and he stomps around in the canyons and he measures these nautiloid fossils. There's these very fascinating creatures from a foot to 2 or 3 feet long even. And, you know, he makes proclamations about how these creatures were laid down. And, of course, the implication here, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge part mm-hmm. that comes out in the creationist literature is that they were laid down by the big flood.
Right? Yeah, sure.
It wasn't just a current of water. It was the big current of water. Right. And, you know, this is at least quasi-science, you know. But even this fails because he's not testing his propositions properly. Just to take this proposition about the nautiloids being laid down in a current, is he out there measuring the whole suite of fossils or just the ones on this one little ledge where he came up with this hypothesis? He has a hypothesis now tested. And the other place where the young earth creationists really fall down in not being able to call themselves scientists, properly call themselves scientists, is that they ignore all the data that disconfirm their views.
Sure.
And that is the thing you absolutely cannot do in science. You can't just look for the stuff that points in your direction. Mm-hmm. If you come across evidence that disproves your position, you have to just swallow hard and admit you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where both versions of creationists really fail.
So then would you say that people who promote intelligent design, instead of trying to find evidence for their claims, they're more looking for gaps between the evidence of the opposition?
The intelligent design people are kind of an interesting case in another direction. Looking for problems with evolution is part and parcel of both wings of the creationist movement, so to speak. But the ID people are kind of interesting for another reason. The basic premise of intelligent design is that X, whether it's the bacteria flagellum or the blood clotting cascade or this particular enzyme system, pick whatever, X is too complicated or too improbable to be explained through natural selection.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if natural selection can't explain this, it has to have been guided by some sort of intelligence. Now, they have this outfit up in Seattle called the Biologic Research Institute, which doesn't seem to do any research. But then again, when you think about it, if the whole premise of your field is we can't explain this through science, you can kind of understand why a research institute isn't going to be cranking up.
Right. If you're looking for ignorance instead of evidence, yeah, you're not going to look too hard.
There's this internal problem with your whole rationale there. But what you'll find the Biologic Institute people doing is, coming up with here's a situation, here's an enzyme system, or here's a structure, which we calculate would require X number of mutations to produce. And therefore, since it's so incredibly improbable that this number of mutations would occur in the sequence, therefore, it couldn't be produced through natural selection. And they toss in irreducible complexity, of course, that whole silliness. And so therefore, an intelligence must have been involved.
How valid would you say is that math? And what's the problem with that argument, throwing out those large numbers and probabilities?
Well, the main problem with it, it's a straw man argument, because nobody really believes that a 100 amino acid protein, for example, is built by putting these two amino acids together and there being a selective advantage. And now we'll add a third and there's a selective advantage. And now we'll have the fourth and there's a selective advantage. Right. Nobody believes that that's the way proteins are constructed.
Do you think they actually think that evolutionists believe that, or are they deluded?
I don't know.
Okay.
But this is what they say. What they think is, I can't see their hearts, so to speak, so I don't know what they're actually thinking. But this is what they say, or this is how they act like they're believing, that evolutionary biologists actually think that this is how a protein is built. And that's nonsense, because that's not how we think proteins are built. They're built in much bigger clumps, for one thing.
And you've told them this in the courtrooms, and they still don't get it.
They don't seem to get it. They who knows why? But yeah, it has certainly been called to their attention on numerous occasions that, no, this is not what we think. Now, would you like to actually talk about what we believe? But there has actually been a considerable literature, even within the last couple of years, that show quite clearly that you can get highly improbable structures. Well, not like a vertebrate eye or something like that, but, they claimed a two or three enzyme system could not be produced through natural selection. Well, bingo, there is one. And the literature does have these obvious refutations, but they don't seem to have really sunk in terribly much. But, ultimately, the intelligent design argument is a religious argument. So really, no matter how much you refute the science, the people who hold these views are not likely to be swayed by just being exposed to more science. You have to really attack, if you will, you have to undermine the foundational premises that these people have, which essentially gets down to, in both the young earth creationist or the intelligent design camp, this dichotomous view that if evolution is true, I lose big.
Right.
If evolution is true, I can't believe in God, I won't be saved, I won't see my loved ones in heaven anymore. And this is a big deal for people of this religious tradition.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. We actually have this quote from you that they feel that either evolution happened or God loves you, which you thought was just perfectly put. And if you know that it's that charged of an emotional issue, then is it more important to teach people the truth about evolution or to just make sure that they keep creationism out of the classroom?
Number one, you have to teach evolution. Children need to be scientifically literate, and evolution is just too big a subject area to eliminate from the curriculum. It has to be taught. Now, as to persuasion, if you will, which I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that was something you might have been getting to add also. Mm-hmm. It depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to a strongly conservative Christian, no amount of science is likely to make much of a dent, and you're kind of spinning your wheels, to mix mm-hmm. a metaphor here. On the other hand, if another evangelical Christian who accepts evolution can talk to that person and assuage that person's concern that, you know, you don't have to give up your faith in order to understand science, that's a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be more effective than just giving them a bunch of facts about evolution.
Yeah, because there's a vested interest, shall we say, on the part of a conservative Christian from this tradition to not believe you.
Right.
But if you can take that fear away, so to speak, by introducing that person to another evangelical tradition that's more open to evolution, and there are. I mean, you know, there are evangelicals out there who accept evolution, and they are the best ambassadors to that wing of the public who feel that they have to reject evolution. But, you know, most Americans are not conservative Christians, but they also, unfortunately, don't know very much about science, and they don't know very much about evolution. And there certainly is an important role for just raising the general public understanding of science, whether it's specifically evolution or science as a way of knowing. There is a role for shoveling science at people. I'm all for it. But it's more likely to stick, it's more likely to be absorbed, shall we say, by people who don't have a vested interest in not accepting it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're curious about you and your background, how you got involved in this subject to begin with. Were you ever a believer in creationism?
No, I've always, actually, I got interested in evolution at a very young age. I was in junior high, actually, and my older sister started the University of Minnesota, where we were living, and she brought home an anthropology book, and I was flipping through it, and I saw these wonderful old reconstructions of the Peking man and Heidelberg man and Neanderthal man. They were all man, of course, you know, because we're talking about, you know, the late 1950s, okay? And I was just, what is this? This is anthropology. Oh, I want to be an anthropologist. So, and I became one. But it was evolution, human evolution, that really hooked me on anthropology first and then evolution in general. And, you know, the rest is history, so to speak.
But what got you into educating people about evolution and feeling that you should be fighting creationism in the classroom, in the courtroom?
I started, got my university degree, and then I actually taught out here in California for a couple of years with a master's degree, and then I went back to get my PhD in the early 1970s. And my professor at the University of Missouri, Jim Gavin, gave me some literature from the Institute for Creation Research. And I thought this was the most fascinating thing I'd ever
heard.
Here I was studying to be a scientist, right? And they said they were doing creation science, and I just had to know more. This is just it was just too fascinating. So it was sort of almost from a philosophy of science standpoint that I got interested in the creationism issue, and so I started collecting their literature. And you know, fine, that was great. In 1974, I was hired by the University of Kentucky is to teach physical anthropology there. And of course, that means I'm teaching human evolution from day one, right? And yeah, I got, even though students coming to an anthropology class, generally speaking, are pretty self-selected. Mm-hmm. You don't have an awful lot of I mean, they're just not going to be happy here. So I didn't get an awful lot of pushback, but I got some. And in talking to my Christian students, I got a little better appreciation for how wrenching some of these discoveries were to these kids. I mean, you have to realize that a state like Kentucky, that kind of one end of it is Appalachia, and yet you also have big urban centers like Louisville and Lexington and the suburbs of Cincinnati, which kind of, you know, go over into the north of Kentucky. And so you've got some really good urban schools, but then you've got some of these county schools where, you know, the library is a shelf in the principal's room, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're seriously disadvantaged kids. Yeah. And yet they also come from very strong families, very loving families, very strong culture with which they identify, and properly so. And they show up at the big city, Lexington or Louisville, at the big university, and all of a sudden, so many of the things that they'd been raised with that they just assumed are just set on their ear. What? The world is not 6,000 years old? That's what they told me in my geology class. That's what they told me in my astronomy class. And I'm even getting it here in anthropology. I mean, this is a really tough thing for these kids. Yeah. And they get smacked with it from all directions, so to speak, because the university environment is a very different one from the one that these kids came from, by and large.
I remember when I was going into college and I was in the Christian tradition, I remember being taught specifically, like, college is a time when God challenges you, and all these liberal professors are bringing their philosophies to you. Did you get this too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you need to fight this. It's sort of God's challenge to you.
That's that kind of dichotomous choice that is just so poisonous. There actually are three possible ways of going, but the tendency was to go in one of two ways. One was just to leave the university and go back home because it was just too hard, and they realized that if they stayed, you know, and continued to believe all these new ideas that were coming through, and I mean, they're getting assaulted on all kinds of sides, not just the age of the earth, but any number of other things that they have taken for granted and assumed that everybody else believed as well. But the other thing is that you're going to jump both feet into the modern world, so to speak, both feet into the secular society, which means, unfortunately, you're cut off from your family, from the people who love you, from your social support, from the people who have picked you up any other time when you've been knocked down, and whom you love also.
Yeah.
You know, that's a horrible, horrible choice for people to make. And of course, there are, you know, middle ways. They do involve making some compromises in theology, I'm afraid, because unfortunately you can't decide that the earth is actually 2 billion years old, which is kind of halfway between 6,000 and 4 billion. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
You kind of have to accept the whole science.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the religious people that we work with a lot, moderate and liberal theologians and lay people that are still people of faith, I mean, their view is that, as one theologian told me, if you don't have a theology that's consonant with the real world, you don't have much of a theology.
Well, I'm a perfect example of that, because in high school I was taught creationism out of a Bob Jones University textbook, which I still have. And when I got to college, I learned about evolution, and that's a large part of what kind of brought me away from faith, even while I was a Bible study leader. So do you think it would be a better tactic for Christian parents to really teach their kids about evolution, because then the kids want to have that kind of culture shock and scientific shock when they get to college?
Number one, just a quick thought. This is why so many conservative Christian parents send their kids to Bible colleges rather than sending them to the state universities.
So they never have that.
That's
experience.
Right. It's sort of a cotton bubble world, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But if you do send your child, your young person, to a secular university, it's really clear if they take any sciences at all, they're going to be faced with a major disconnect between a view of the natural world that they may have received from their religious teachings and what they're finding out is plenty of evidence for. You know, I'm not an apologist for religion or for atheism. I think people have to find their own path. And some people are very happy being atheists. Some people would not at all be happy. And they would be a lot happier and live better lives maybe if they had a more moderate form of religion than perhaps some of the views that some of these young people that we've been talking about come into university with. But, you know, the fact of the matter is this dichotomous idea that you have to choose either between being a good guy Christian creationist or a bad guy atheist evolutionist is what is driving a lot of people either away from science or away from faith. I am more concerned with people being driven away from science because I'm not a person of faith, and I figure I'll let the religious people worry about that aspect. But I think it's very sad if people are not being exposed to and being allowed to really appreciate and experience what a fascinating world science opens you up to.
Right. Yeah.
And those kinds of dichotomous views are very poisonous, I think.
Well, as we mentioned before, we like to get interactive. We like to go experience things firsthand. So we recently went to a creation museum. Do you do that? Would you go to a creation museum for fun? And would you recommend that people do that or stay away?
Well, I mean, I certainly go to creationist museums. Yeah, I mean, I may have a slightly different style from you guys. I'm not sure. But I certainly went to the Creation Museum up in Petersburg in northern Kentucky. There was a North American paleontological meeting a few years ago, and I was so pleased. They invited me to speak, number one. That was great. But number two, they arranged a field trip of the paleontologists to go en masse in buses to the Creation Museum.
Oh, my goodness.
Did everyone behave themselves?
Of course. Of course.
Oh, good.
Good.
Okay.
Certainly.
Yeah, we're always friendly. That's our tactic.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's part of being a civilized human being, really. It was great fun. Well, it was great fun and really dismaying. I mean, I encouraged the field trip. The organizers had said, well, you know, these guys want to do this field trip. What do you think? Is this a good idea? I said, yes, definitely do it. I said, this will be the most educational thing for the scientists because they will learn a lot about what, you know, what people on the other side think about evolution. And if they haven't had that kind of firsthand experience, this is a good opportunity to get it.
Absolutely.
And the AIG people, the Answers in Genesis people, were just thrilled that we showed up. They could not have been
really
happy. Oh, they were just ecstatic. They, of course, gave, you know, they gave the group rate. We got a break on how much we had to pay to get in. And, but they had somebody to meet us when the buses drove up, and they were just doing handsprings. They were so glad we were there. Yeah. I mean, I find creationists to be very friendly and open and happy people. I mean, they, but the AIG people were just this in spades. It was kind of like they felt that if we only go through this museum, there will be this great, you know, palm smacking on the forehead. Oh my God, the scales are now falling from my eyes.
They're that confident. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course the paleontologists walked in and they looked at these exhibits and they were just, oh my God.
Yeah.
There were not a lot of scales falling from eyes.
Did they point out any of the flaws in the exhibits or inconsistencies or pose any probing questions or just kind of observe?
Well, no, I mean, there was probably 40 or 50 of us or something. We all just kind of scattered when we went in.
Okay.
I mean, it was totally impractical for them to take us through as a group. And,
sure.
And you know, there's a lot of other people there who are, you know, people bringing their kids and grandma and everybody out for the weekend. And no, you're not going to start a fight with another zoo-goer, okay? You know, this is silly.
Well, would you pinpoint like a particular type of exhibit or argument that would kind of grate you the most, that would be sort of the most irritating?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to think now. It's been a couple of years since I saw it. I mean,
or in general, you know, something that's brought up in a courtroom.
Something that was pretty offensive at the Creation Museum up there in Kentucky was this presentation of the idea, kind of along the lines we were talking about a little bit earlier, that anybody who accepts evolution, of course, they would say believe in evolution, right? But anybody who accepts evolution is bound for hell. And they have these various little videos and some exhibits and murals and stuff that purport to show the bad things that'll happen to you. And so there's this teenage girl and, you know, yes, she studied evolution in school and here she is checking her pregnancy test.
Oh.
What a terrible thing to imply.
And he studied evolution in school and there he is, you know, connecting with his drug dealer.
Oh my goodness.
Post hoc ergo propter hoc.
So it's sort of like if you learn evolution and you believe it, this is the big fear.
Here's two invented anecdotes to prove that.
But they illustrate the underlying fear, which is if you have evolution and you accept evolution, then you have to give up your faith in God. If you don't have a faith in God, there's no reason for you to behave well. And as somebody who is not a person of faith, I'm a humanist. I don't believe in God, but I haven't killed anybody in weeks.
Right. Forgot to schedule that.
At the Creationist Museum that we went to in Santee, they had a bumper sticker, and I got one and gave it to Don Prothero, who came with us. And it said, It said, if you're afraid of global warming, it's nothing compared to the fires of hell.
Oh, Don, I'm sure you just warmed his heart.
Yeah. After going through the whole museum, which took us a couple of hours, he was, a little hot under the collar. So when I gave him that, he was very excited. We felt so bad for him. We were like, we got you something.
Of course, Don is also, an expert on climate change. And they had a dedicated exhibit there within the Creation Museum about global warming and how that's a big myth being promulgated by, the scientific elite and the government.
Yeah, I need to go down and see that museum because that used to be the old ICR Museum.
Right.
Yes. Yeah,
and,
if you want to go, we'll take you.
They sold it to this new company. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to see how many of the old exhibits are there. I don't remember a global warming exhibit, so that may be new.
That's new. And there's kind of a new wing that's dedicated to like biological science and, it's...
It's just about like human biology.
Yeah, but I guess it gives them the imprimatur of, just looking more legitimate than they are.
And actually, when we walked in, the docent said, oh, well, here's the old wing, but this part is the part about the human body, and tried to sort of direct us there.
Yeah. Interesting.
Look, we've got some incontrovertible science. But I've been there before, and it's largely the same. Like, all the main exhibits haven't changed.
The big arc that where you're looking down the corridor into the great.
Yep.
Love it.
And now they have a bunch of Answers in Genesis lit, which Don was pointing out they wouldn't have had before because
they were competing
at the time.
Very good observation. Yeah. Although it's interesting, though, if you look at their catalogs, they do kind of cross-post, so to speak. But I think less so recently. AIG is kind of really gotten to be such a, such a big operation that I think they're doing less of that these days.
We also have been involved in the last couple months with Reasons to Believe, which is Hugh Ross's organization.
Oh, yeah. We attended one of his talks. And
yes.
Yeah, very different approach.
Yes, he has something called the Skeptics Forum, where you can show up if you have questions, and particularly if you're a believer in evolution, and sort of pose your challenges to him. Which we did.
Yes. And he had a very unique blend of biblical literalism and yet an acceptance of the scientific understanding of the age of the earth.
Yeah, he's an old earth creationist. He calls himself a day age creationist, but he's not really. Hmm. He's really a progressive creationist, which is a kind of view that accepts that the earth is billions of years old. And he's an astronomer from University of Toronto. I mean, this guy is not from some Bible college. He actually has some real training. And he's fully on board with Big Bang and the whole cosmological evolution stuff, and he's cool about that. But he kind of chokes at biology. That's the problem.
Right.
And so for Hugh and for other progressive creationists, he has God creating sequentially. So first God creates single-celled organisms, and then he creates simple metazoa, and then more complicated metazoa, and then he creates a Cambrian explosion of invertebrate body plans, and then he gets into simple chordates, and then lions and tigers and bears come, a little later on. It's definitely a special creation view. I mean, it's not... They're old earthers, but they don't believe that one kind, so to speak, gives rise to another kind. He believes in the created kinds. I was on a path, I'm quite fond of Hugh. He's really quite a gentleman, and he's just been kicked up one side and down another by the young earthers. They just can't stand this guy. Mm-hmm. They are just horribly, they're just really mean to Hugh Ross. I mean, that's the only thing you can say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says he's a Bible-believing Christian, but he's an old earther.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that kind of kicks the slats under their view. So, he's a much bigger problem for them than I am, right?
Okay.
I'm a godless heathen, so I don't count.
You're easier to write off.
Precisely. He's not. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Hugh and I were on a panel once. We put it on YouTube so other people can see it now, too. But we were on a panel at a church in the South Bay. Hugh and I and Dwayne Gish, interestingly enough. Hugh just made a couple of statements that just were just amazing. I mean, I thought, oh, Hugh, why? But
do you remember
he was talking? Yeah, he was talking about how God really loved horses because he made so many of them.
Oh,
okay.
Okay.
And God
loves
God
beetles.
Really
and
liked
mosquitoes.
And God really, well, he's talking about species, right? And God really liked God really loved primates because he made so many of them. I bit my tongue. I should have said, boy, then he must be totally crazy about bats.
Right.
Because there's more species of bats than any other kind of mammal. I mean, you know, bats are just cluttering up mammal-tude all over.
What does God have against monotremes? I mean, the platypus is my favorite.
God, I'm sure that represents God's sense of humor. But yeah, there's a real inconsistency with the progressive creationist view, needless to say.
Sure.
Is there one that you like better? Would you prefer there to be millions upon millions of literal 6-day, you know, 6,000-year creationists? Or do you think the old earth creationism is better?
Well, you know, the more science you accept, I think the healthier the situation is. So clearly somebody who accepts astronomy and geology but maybe chokes on biology is in better shape than somebody who doesn't accept any science, right? So, you know, you at least have a chance of kind of reaching somebody who accepts some basic principles of science. And really, you know, there's a lot of basic principles in physics and chemistry and geology.
Okay, so what, for our listeners who are listening to this conversation and saying, I agree with you, but what on earth do I do? What can people do for kids who are being indoctrinated in the classroom? Is there something we can do about this situation?
There's not as much of the actual teaching of creationism in the classroom as there used to be. I think word has gotten out, this is unconstitutional, you will get in big trouble if you do it. It happens. We know that. If you do encounter any sort of, guess what we learned in school today, Mom, and they bring home some of this sketchy material, call the National Center for Science Education. We need to talk. We can advise you. Every situation has its own idiosyncrasies, and the best thing to do is let us know, and we'll help put you in touch with allies locally, and we'll give you some advice that has worked elsewhere. Now, a bigger problem is that many teachers feel intimidated and just simply stop teaching evolution, which means that kids get an inadequate science education. And that is something to be worried about. So if you have children yourself, or if you have neighbors with kids, or you know kids, find out, you know, what are you learning in middle school life science? What are you learning in high school biology? Is evolution being taught, or are those chapters just getting skipped? What teachers need is to feel that they're supported by parents who are concerned about getting a good science education for their children. Because what they tend to hear from is the parents who don't want their kids to be taught evolution. And it's the heckler's veto.
Mm-hmm.
The parents who say, you're not going to teach evolution this year, are you, Mrs. Brown? And Mrs. Brown, you know, has probably several expletives going through her mind at that point. No, 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 Mrs. Jones, I'm afraid that we have so much to do. We just probably won't get to those chapters.
But we should be on the other side saying, you're not going to skip evolution, are you?
Or you even make it a little bit more positive that, well, gee, I'm really glad that we live in the state of X. California is a very good example, where evolution is really strongly required in the state science education standards. And I just want you to know, Mrs. Brown, that if anybody gives you any flack for teaching evolution, you just let me know, and I'll be happy to have a conversation with them and help them understand how important it is that evolution be taught. Now, the probability that the teacher is going to send anybody to you is zero. But the point being is that you have expressed your willingness to help and your support in a very positive way. You haven't threatened the teacher. The last thing you want is to go up and say, you're going to teach this, right? Because, you know, that puts you in the same kind of, you want to be that teacher's partner, not that teacher's adversary.
Sure.
Very good.
Makes sense to me.
And keep track of what's going on in your local school board. And if anything kind of sketchy shows up, you let us know.
This Christmas, I gave Ross a membership to the National Center for Science Education.
You're a good person.
Oh, stop.
A wonderful gift.
So yes, it is, Ross. So for people who want to give that as a gift or who want to join the organization, what are they supporting?
They are supporting my staff and a quite modest office, I must say, and in a not terribly fancy part of Oakland, California. And you are supporting my staff, which gives that kind of grassroots advice to the parents and the teachers and the school boards and the state legislatures when science education needs to be defended. Sometimes I use the analogy that there are plenty of brush fires all over this country. People need to fight them. We hand out the fire extinguishers. We depend very much on local people who are willing to do the hard work. We can give you advice on what's worked elsewhere, and we can give you information on the science or the law or the pedagogy or the religion or whatever, you know, whatever is needed to help solve your problem. We can put you in touch with other allies in your state or community. We can give you advice on how to make a good presentation to the school board, if that's necessary, or how to write a letter to the editor. We do a lot of that kind of grassroots handholding, so to speak.
Great.
For helping people work through these problems. And, you know, the idea is to come up with a compromise so that the decision makers do the right thing. And so a lot of times affect is very important. How you present mm-hmm. yourself and your view makes a huge amount of difference if you live in a democracy where you can't just bludgeon people into doing what you want them to do. You have to persuade them.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of being persuasive, what would you give as an elevator pitch if someone was saying, quick, convince me of evolution? What's the best case?
The best case is all the different kinds of evidence that point to the idea that living things had common ancestors. Common ancestry is what evolution means. And if you look at anatomy or biochemistry or embryology or the fossil record, it all points to this idea that the diversity of living things today is as it is because living things shared common ancestors. We have descended with modification from common ancestors. Oh, we're at floor 3 now. Have to get off the elevator.
I was going to say, no one has ever said anything that interesting to me on an elevator. I only could wish.
Yeah, so thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Scott.
Well, it's my pleasure. And if any of your listeners are intrigued by what we do, it's a very simple URL. It's ncse.com, National Center for Science Education, ncse.com. Come see us.
Wonderful.
See, I would have accidentally gone to ncse.org. What's there?
Well, ncse.org, alas, is North Carolina Southeast. It's a realtor's organization.
Oh, no.
They founded the domain name before we got it. Rats.
Oh. Awful.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to write a letter.
Don't support them. Go to the .com. Well, thank you so much for everything you do, and thank you so much for talking to us.
It's been fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Our pleasure. So our guest was Dr. Eugenie Scott.
And now, a word from the president of Camp Quest West.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, board president of Camp Quest West, right here in California. We're a secular summer camp for families of atheists, freethinkers, skeptics, and humanists. And we're thrilled to announce 2 California camp sessions this July, one near Sacramento and the other near Los Angeles. In fact, Camp Quest has over a dozen locations throughout the U.S. and a few more overseas. At Camp Quest, we give your kids the traditional camp experience, like archery and swimming, arts and crafts and campfire songs, but we add science, skepticism, humanist principles, and critical thinking. Basically, we tell kids how to think, not what to think. We're accepting registrations now for all camp locations, but we're also asking for your help. Help us support the future of Freethought with a donation. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the Freethought and Skeptic community by people like you. Let's see how much Ross and Carrie's fans can raise for Camp Quest. Visit tinyurl.com/ohnocampquest or look for the link on Ross and Carrie's Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org. Thanks for listening. And now, back to Ross and Carrie.
And I should mention, I am going to be a counselor this year at Camp Quest West.
Oh,
at least,
yay.
Yeah, the Southern California edition. So, send your kids to me.
That's not creepy at all.
No. You filled out a form saying that you would entrust your hypothetical kids with me.
I did. I was Ross's reference.
Yeah.
And actually it asked...
One of my references.
Yeah. It asked how I knew you mm-hmm. and whether you were my coworker or my friend or my relative or all these things. And I couldn't decide exactly what to call you. So I said that you were sort of a friend slash coworker, mm-hmm. but you were really more of a co-host.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Anyway.
We're friends.
Yeah. Well, yes. Of course we're friends. But anyway. Eugenie Scott gave an amazing interview.
We got to talk to Eugenie Scott. How awesome is that?
That was pretty exciting.
This is why we start podcasts.
Yeah, totally. And I got nervous when we – do you remember as we started the interview, I like started getting really nervous, which I haven't on any of our other interviews.
Yeah.
But we wanted to follow up her interview with the other side of the argument.
Right.
By talking to a prominent creationist.
And you reached out to both Answers in Genesis and Reasons to Believe.
Yeah. So Reasons to Believe was Dr. Hugh Ross. They didn't get back to me. Answers in Genesis, which is Ken Ham's organization, sent me to their publicist, and their publicist lined up someone for me, and it turned out she wasn't able to make the interview at the last minute, and no one else that we reached out to has taken us up on it, and we would love to hear the other side of this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you know somebody who's a good representative of the creationist perspective, send them our way.
Yeah, please do. And you can email us at info@onopodcast.com. Of course, you can always find us on the Facebooks.
We would like to give some shout-outs.
Yeah,
to some of our very generous donors.
So, first of all, we have a mystery person who goes only by AC from Oakland, California. Woo!
Woo! Thank you, AC. Also, thank you to Paula Lauterbach for her generous donation.
Woo! Paula!
Ow, Paula!
She sounds familiar. I feel like we know her.
Yeah. So, that's it for our show. Our theme music is composed by none other than Brian Keith Dalton, who you can find at MrDeity.com.
That's a very nice man there. Our show is produced by Ian Kramer.
Ian Kramer! You can find us on the web at onopodcast.com or
facebook.com/onrac, O-N-R-A-C.
And remember,
the only acceptable eugenics program is one that makes a lot of Eugenies.
And if I had a genie, I would wish for three Eugenies.